If your genre of crime is the police procedural, then you're in for a treat. With a pillar to post account from a former Scotland Yard detective. In today's episode, we look at the Eltham Common murder. Hi, and welcome back to the Historical Crimes and Criminals podcast. I'm Steve, your host. Now, if you listen to Sherlock Holmes, and some of us do, then you might believe that all Scotland Yard detectives were incompetent and bunglers. I don't like to disagree with the great man, but it is interesting to watch today's case unfold. And a couple of notes on today's story. Outraged, in the context, means rape. Also, a turner is a worker who operates a machine tool called a turning lathe. And so, on to today's story, by Francis Carling, late Superintendent of Scotland Yard. To vary a modern proverb, an ounce of fact is worth a ton of generalisation. And so to illustrate the inner workings of that grim and practical building, New Scotland Yard, let me give you, in a manner never previously made public, the means by which I brought into the dock at the Old Bailey, David Greenwood, in 1918. The facts of the Eltham Common murder, as they confronted the police, were briefly these. Nellie True was a rather attractive, well-built young woman who lived with her parents at Eltham, near Woolwich, and she was employed on the clerical work at the Arsenal. On the night of February the 9th, 1918, she'd gone for a walk across Eltham Common and was never seen alive again. The discovery of her dead body was made next morning, and the medical evidence showed that she'd been outraged and strangled. No person had seen anyone with her, and there was a total absence of any clues which would lead to the identification of the likely murderer. Investigations as to the girl's habits and any companions she had brought the police no nearer a solution to the mystery. But there had been two things found on the ground beside the body. The two articles were a badge of the Leicestershire Regiment and an ordinary coat button to which was attached a small piece of wire. Assistance from Scotland Yard had been applied for, and I went down to Woolwich to take over the reins of the case, on which an Inspector Brown worked with me. I came on the scene of the crime 4 or 5 days after it had been committed, and the first thing I did was to have photographs made of the badge and the button. From this point onwards, you're coming into my company, as it were, to follow every step I took in finding the unknown murderer of the girl True. I sent these photographs immediately to the press, with the request that every paper in Britain would publish them and ask their readers to come forward should they identify either button or badge as belonging to anyone they knew. Within a short time, a telephone message came to me at the yard from Tottenham Court Road Police Station saying that a man had called that morning and had said he'd seen the photo in a newspaper. He stated further that the badge had belonged to him, but that he had sold it to a man on board a tram travelling between Wellham and Eltham. His statement had been taken down with his name and address, but he had not been detained. I immediately asked Inspector Brown to go to the factory where this man worked and to bring him to my room at Scotland Yard, and within a couple of hours or so, Inspector Brown arrived, and with him a tall, thin youth. I was seated at my desk and the door having been closed, the young man, who was David Greenwood, came forward and stood in front of me. On my desk, lying there quite openly, with a badge and a button. I examined Greenwood's face closely, and then my eyes ran over his clothing, and I saw that his overcoat hung open, and there was not a single button on it. Where the buttons should have been, threads were sticking out, except in one place. That place was where the top button should have been. Instead of the tags of thread, there was a large hole, as though the button had been there, but had been forcibly torn off. I rose from my desk, picked up the button, which had been found beside the body of Nellie True, and walking over to Greenwood, I took his coat and applied the button to the large hole at the top. It fitted. If one can use the expression here, exactly. I said nothing, and I asked him no questions, but I told him to go and wait in another room, and I gave instructions that it should be closely guarded, although of course, he was not technically in custody. Now I must digress for a moment here to impress one thing upon my readers. I can hear some of you say that I'd already got clear and ample proof that I'd found the murderer. But from the Criminal Investigation Department point of view, I had nothing of the kind. To have charged Greenwood and put him up for the murder with no more evidence than that would have meant, for certainty, he would have been discharged. For you must remember that the burden of proof always lies with the Crown, and that, especially when a man's life is at stake, there must not be one single weak link in the chain of evidence, or it will inevitably break when it comes to be submitted to a jury. To return then to Greenwood, I left him at the yard and I went off with Inspector Brown to the factory in Newman Street where Greenwood was employed. My first action was to interview 5 or 6 of his fellow workmen, and needless to say, I saw each of them separately. The works manager, let me say, was one of the most helpful and intelligent men with whom I have ever had to deal with in the course of investigating a case, and I noticed that he appreciated the gravity and importance of every detail of my question of his employees. He put his own room at my disposal, and the workmen came in one by one to be examined by me. Each of the half dozen corroborated the statements of the others, and the burden of the gist of my examination was this: I secured statements from the men which proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that on the day of the murder on Elphin Common, David Greenwood had left the works to go home wearing the Leicester Regiment badge and a buttonhole in the lapel of his coat, that he had every button on his coat at that time, including the top one which, however, differed from the others, insomuch as it was fixed with a small piece of wire instead of being sewn on, like the rest. You will appreciate the importance of my establishing this, I'm sure. Had I not been able to show that Greenwood had the buttons on his coat just immediately before the murder, a clever defending counsel could have shown or tried to show that Greenwood might have been without these buttons for some considerable time before the outrage on Elphin Common. And the suggestion to a jury would have been that the badge and the button might have fallen into the hands of some other person, that person being the probable murderer. And now perhaps you're asking a question which I certainly put to myself at the time. Why did David Greenwood go to the Tottenham Court Road police station and report the police himself that he'd been the owner of the badge? I got the answer to that question at the works. It appeared that when the photographs came out in the press, one of his fellow workmen who had seen them said to Greenwood, "I say, that badge in the photograph in the paper is the same as the one you've been wearing." Greenwood said it was nothing of the kind, and there was a heated argument between the two. At length, however, the other man said to Greenwood firmly, "You got to go to the police station and tell them that it's your badge that's in the photo. If you don't go, I'll take you there myself." Greenwood saw then that it was useless for him to avoid going to the police, and apparently determined to make the best of the damning circumstances in which he was placed, he worked up the story of having sold the badge to a man on a tram whilst on the way home to Woolwich from work. And that was a tale he had told at Tottenham Court Road. He had done something else, however. On his way to the police station, he had torn all the other buttons from his overcoat, with the idea, I suppose, that if they were all off, the absence of the top button would not be so easily remarked. I was able to prove this last resort of Greenwood by the fact that more than one of men could swear that on the morning of the day he'd gone to Tottenham Court Road police station, he'd arrived at work with all the buttons on his coat except the telltale one, and that it was only when he returned to the factory that the threads were sticking out from where the other buttons had been. After I carried out my close examination of the various workmen, I found myself alone in the room with Inspector Brown and the works manager. I turned to him and said, "You use wire in your works here? I noticed in passing through. Where do you get it from? Any special place?" "It's all specially made for us," he replied. "You see, we're engaged on aeroplane fitting work here, and the wire we use is of a particular kind." "Could it be possible for you to identify your own wire?" I asked him. "Certainly," he answered. "Do you mean to say if I put down a number of pieces of wire that you could tell me exactly which ones were yours?" I further put it to him. His reply was again emphatic. "Will you kindly go out of the room for a moment?" I requested of him, and he did so. I took the small piece of wire, which was attached to the button, which had been found lying on the ground of Elphin Common beside the body of Nellie True, and which was now in my possession, and I laid it on the table in front of me. I got several other pieces of wire of approximately the same size, picked up haphazard in the works, which I'd come in, quite unknown to anyone there, and I laid about half a dozen pieces of wire on the table beside the first piece. Then I called the works manager. "Now, first of all, before I go any further, I must warn you of the gravity of what I'm going to ask and impress on you, which depends on the answer you might make. You understand?" He was quite deadly pale with emotion, but he replied quite firmly that he was fully aware of the import of the matter, and I was convinced that he fully realised to the great extent of the question of whether a man would stand on the gallows to hang for the murder, and this would depend on him. "Well then, will you tell me, please, which of these pieces of wires are yours?" He looked carefully at each piece of wire in turn, took them up, examined them closely. Then he said decidedly, "All of them." "Every piece? Are you sure?" "I am sure." "Still, I wanted further confirmation of the identification of the wire, and telling the works manager to go into another room which adjoined the one I sat in, I sent for the works foreman. To him, I put the same questions, and I'm putting through the same tests with the pieces of wire, and I got the same unequivocal answers from him as from the manager, and at last I felt satisfied beyond any doubt the wire which was attached to the button beside Nellie True's body had come from the aeroplane works in Newman Street, where David Greenwood worked. When I left the works, and when Inspector Brown and I got outside, he asked me whither I was bound now." "To Greenwood's home," I replied, as I hailed a taxi and told the man to drive with all possible speed to Wellhall, where Greenwood's parents lived. For I saw now there was only one possible loophole which Greenwood might possibly escape his conviction, and that was an attempt to establish an alibi, and I was determined to skewer my evidence on that point before there could be any chance of the fabric of an alibi being woven. I saw each of Greenwood's relatives in turn. By one, I was informed that he had gone for a long time without any buttons on his coat, as he had observed that being a thin youth, he thought he looked better with his coat open to make him look more squarely built. This same person told me that he'd gone out very late on the night of the crime, after supper in fact, at an hour that was obviously later than the tune in which the medical evidence proved the death of Nellie True to have taken place. I was also informed that Greenwood had gone out without his coat, in spite of the fact that this member of the family had told him to put it on as it was cold. From another of his relatives, I gleaned that it was no means clear that Greenwood had gone out without his coat, and the hour of his leaving did not tally with the time given me by another member of the family. Finally, I left the house after making a careful search amongst Greenwood's own things for bloodstains, and I went off to interview still another one of his family who was at his place of work. Again, there was a disagreement about the time of David Greenwood's leaving home on the night of the murder, and the net result of my queries went to show that it would be practically impossible for Greenwood to establish that strongest of all defences, an alibi. Now, let me be absolutely frank with you on the score of evidence from the relatives of any man charged with a crime, particularly that of murder, where his life is at stake. We detectives are nonetheless human, because we are detectives, and at all times in cases of this nature, we realise it's only natural that mothers, sisters and other relatives of the accused man should do all they can to possibly try and establish his innocence. It's not a case of telling falsehoods. It's similar to what the police find in simple cases of street accidents. Six different eyewitnesses' statements are taken and have six different stories, all of them equally truthful in the real sense of the word, but all showing that no two people can see a thing or occurrence alike. So with the movements of a man who had committed a crime, and the really strange thing would be if those of whom he is nearest and dearest to should not see the case in the manner which is most likely to prove that he's innocent. In the instance of David Greenwood, however, I, as a representative of the law, was concerned with one thing only. If Greenwood were the guilty man, then I had to bring him to justice and show by irrefutable evidence that he was certainly the guilty man, on the strength of the case which had built up out of that badge and button. I knew that he had indeed murdered Nellie True, and I saw there was no possible alibi which he could put up to show that he was wrongly accused. I returned to the yard, and I sent for Greenwood to come to my room again, and I said to him, "It is open to you to give an account of your movements on Saturday, the day of the crime. You can do so if you like, but it will be taken down by Inspector Brown and may be used in evidence against you." He replied, "I should like it to be taken down." "Very well," I said, "you can say whatever you like and Mr. Brown will write it down." Greenwood then made a statement. I shall not reproduce it here for word, but it was to the effect that he was never near the scene of the murder, and although he had gone out that evening, he had not worn his overcoat. He said he'd spent most of the evening at home, and then about 10 o'clock he'd gone out to an eating house to get his supper, and that, in effect, as far as the statement went. After making the statement, during the recording, which I sat at my desk without saying a word, Greenwood signed each page of it, and as he straightened himself up after bending over to sign his name, he looked hard at my desk, on which lay the badge and the button. His hand went out hesitatingly, and he picked up the button, held it for a moment, and regarded it in a fixed manner. Then he spoke. If I say that this is my button, what will it mean? I cannot tell you, I replied. He stared at the button again for some time, and then, almost for the first time during my interview with him, he looked me directly in the eyes. At last he muttered, "Well, I won't say it then." No more was said at that moment, except I told him that I should detain him pending further inquiries, and I gave instructions that he should be taken to Cannon Row Police Station and put in a cell there. Cannon Row is just adjacent to Scotland Yard. Later, I went over to the station and I had Greenwood brought out of the cell he was in, and I said to him, "David Greenwood, I shall charge you with the willful murder of Nellie True on the 9th of February on Eltham Common." His naturally thin, wan face went a shade paler. His mouth opened in a helpless manner, and he breathed out rather than said, "Yes." Then I got him into a motor car and took him to Woolwich Police Station, where he was formally charged. This time, he did not even say yes. The trial took place at the Old Bailey before Mr. Justice Aiken. Travers Humphreys was the Crown Counsel in the case, while Mr. Slezer defended Greenwood. The evidence for the prosecution was built up entirely on the various points I have unfolded one by one, and it was what we call by the Criminal Investigation Department and the lawyers circumstantial. As I anticipated, the chief line of defence was an alibi, coupled with the allegation that Greenwood had sold the badge to another man, and it was not actually in his possession at the actual time of the murder. But the evidence I supplied showed clearly that, at the very least, Greenwood had worn the badge on the evening of the murder, and that, for the first time to the knowledge of his fellow workmen, the top button of his overcoat was missing on the Monday after the crime, and that in its place there was a rent which must have been made by the button being torn off. I had reconstructed the murder in my own mind. I could see Greenwood seize hold of Nellie True, throw her to the ground. I could visualise the struggle in which the 16-year-old girl had made to defend herself on the lonely, bleak common, not a soul in sight, nor hearing to whom she could appeal for help. And then, as she lay on the ground, Greenwood, to quiet her and prevent her from struggling, had seized her by the throat and had strangled her. And in her death struggles, the girl had groped out frantically with her hands. In doing so, she'd caught the top of Greenwood's overcoat and pulled the badge out of the buttonhole. One other plea in defence was put forward. The defendant counsel, cross-examining Dr. Spilsbury, now Sir Bernard Spilsbury, the celebrated pathologist and Home Office medical expert, tried to bring in the theory that a man who had been discharged from the army, suffering from disordered action of the heart and fainting fits, as Greenwood had done, could not have caused the injuries that Nellie True had suffered. Bernard Spilsbury replied that he could not say that such a man would not be able to do so. The jury retired and they were absent for nearly 3 hours. At the end of that time, they came out of the box again and the foreman announced a verdict of guilty. But the foreman added that in view of the youth of the prisoner, his service to his country and his previous good character, they desired to recommend him to mercy. Greenwood stood up in the dock, with every vestige of colour gone from his face, to receive sentence. But his voice was firm enough as he spoke in answer to the judge's usual question as to whether he had anything to say before sentence was passed upon him. He said, "I wish your lordship to take no notice of the recommendation of the jury, as rather than face the disgrace, I would rather pay the full penalty of this crime," and he declared his innocence again. Justice Atkin addressed him. You have been found guilty of the most heinous crime. You have taken your poor, unfortunate victim's life. In that crime, there is only one penalty. At the same time, I shall forward the recommendation of the jury to the proper authorities where, I have no doubt, it will receive every consideration. It is not right, however, that you should anticipate that in the course of the law will necessarily be interfered with on the account of that recommendation. Then the black cap was produced, and the judge passed the dreaded sentence. Greenwood, however, did not hang. After long deliberation on the part of the Home Secretary, his sentence was commuted to one of penal servitude for life. David Greenwood was released in 1933 at the age of 36. Francis Carlin wrote his reminiscences in 1927, and he died in 1930. Well, that's it for another episode of the Historical Crimes and Criminals podcast. I hope you enjoyed that one. And if you did, please like, subscribe, and I'll see you in the next episode. Bye-bye.